I have something here, Clinton. You ever heard of Walter Benjamin?
Yeah. His name comes up a lot. I don't think I've ever looked into him specifically. He's something of a philosopher, right?
He's what? You're muffled. What was the last
something
word?
Something of a philosopher? Is that correct? I've heard of him.
Yes. Okay, so we would say Walter Benjamin, but the Europeans say Benjamin. And he's the commies' answer to McLuhan in 1968. Hannah Arendt reissued his book called Illuminations. And
that's how I know him, from Hannah Arendt. Okay, that's right. Okay. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah. And he wrote a famous essay in the 30s, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. So he said something's, being an art critic and aesthete, he said something's up here with the art world because we now have new media, movies and radio. What's this going to mean? So McLuhan becomes famous in 67. And people might find out he's a Catholic or a Canadian or something that they could disapprove. So Hannah Arendt scrambled together and retrieved this guy, and he became the media expert of Marxism, of the Frankfurt School. And he'd written other stuff after that 1935 essay. And he goes on to be a big deal, and it's the fountain of media studies in the Marxist world, since they can't quote a Catholic, Marshall McLuhan. So I found recently the BBC is doing a big thing on Zappa this weekend, and in the course of looking at that, I saw the BBC had done something on Walter Benjamin. Now the Zappa thing has Ben Watson making commentary. He's a an intellectual graduate of Cambridge who wrote a book on Zapp in 94. And we did this in pretty interesting series on London radio back in 2008, 36 episodes where he looked at Zappa through the eyes of a Marxist and I looked at Zappa through the eyes of McLuhan. So that's an interesting dialogue. Well, his wife, Ben's wife, is a professor at Birkbeck in University of London. And she's become well known as an expert on Walter Benjamin. So they feature her and another woman and a guy. So it's an hour-long show, but the first 20 minutes is about his youth and how he became a writer. But we don't start there. We start with the essay, 1935. So this is somebody Greg could look at for media analysis. We'll see how Greg responds to this. Marx's attempt at media studies or media ecology. And we'll listen with our usual super informed ears, Clinton.
Yes.
And Brian will come in with his eccentric, ridiculous Toronto bohemian take on everything. And it should be interesting.
Yeah.
Bring it, Brian. Bring it, you bohemian.
Bring it, Brian. Bring it. So I sent it to Bill this morning, and he said, nah, we can't get it off of BBC. It'd take me an hour to download. There's not enough time. But then he decided to look at it, work it out, and I told him, well, we have an hour of music, so you got time to download it and all that. So he did, and so we have it here. So let's, unless something
happens. Thank you, Bill.
Yes.
Thank you for your service.
Look at this. Phil says, at least the BBC are doing something worthwhile with my license fee. Yeah, there's a slave state over there in England. The original Fabian socialist problem. But, so this is about 40 minutes. I think you find it interesting, how they, talk about, this, eccentric guy. He was a smart kid, but when he wrote his PhD in Germany or something, he had to do two parts. First part was accepted. The second part, nobody understood it. I don't know what he wrote about. Look it up on Wikipedia, but they just couldn't understand it. So they wouldn't give his PhD, so he never got to be a teacher in university. So he had to survive by being a journalist. And that led him into doing newspaper articles and radio and all kinds of modern media that the other OBs, preneurinated bastards, wouldn't do, right? They look down on that. But that sort of worked out in the long run for Benjamin because electric media took over in the long run, especially with the baby boomers. So he became a big hero in the late 60s, probably in Europe first because he was in German. And
Still alive or active, or was he just retrieved by Hannah Arendt posthumously?
So from 1925 to 1940, he hopped all over Europe. He would go to Moscow. He was a Marxist, but he also did stuff in Germany. He knew Bertolt Brecht. He knew everybody. And he had no money, so he'd crash at everybody's place. And he knew a lot of people in Paris. So he was like the original networker, taking advantage of modern conveniences. So, but when the Nazis took over Paris, he was there. He says, geez, I gotta get out of here. He was Jewish. So he goes down to the French-Spanish border, and Spain had just, right when he got there, they said, no, we're not letting any more people in here. He had gotten a visa to, allowed to go into the States, but he didn't have a visa to get out of France. So he sat there, that day, the sad day, and at nighttime, he said, this is it. He was sick anyways. He said, oh, hell with it. So he committed suicide in 1940, maybe in June 1940. So he's a famous suicide who escaped the Nazis that way. So
to speak. Okay, wow. Yeah.
So he became, you know, once he died after World War II, the Frankfurt School started to publish some of redo his books, but he became, as you hear in this documentary, he becomes really big in the student radicals of the 60s, and there's a poster that they're going to describe of what he looks like. He did experiment with drugs and did all that stuff, so he was a wild and crazy namby-pamby intellectual, and he wasn't tough enough to handle the Nazis. But he became a big deal. And so if you look at Derrida and all those people who became popular in the 80s, they all quote Benjamin. He's their big guru. They begin with him. They might take it further, but he's a big deal. So you would, when you read some of that stuff, you would have seen his name if you read closely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's a big deal, and Ben Watson's wife is an expert on this. Her name is Esther. So there's Carolyn and Kevin or something, Kevin or Keith. So if it's not those two names, it's Esther talking. I think she even did a book on Benjamin. The British guy, the host, he keeps saying Benjamin. At first he corrects himself, but then he gives up, keeps saying Benjamin. He doesn't want to say Benjamin. Benjamin. Okay. So I will click on it. Are you ready, Greg? Ready to learn something new? This is to help you do media studies, Greg.
Hold on. Yes. I thought I was muted, but I thought I muted myself. I think I'm muted to Minimax instead. There. Sorry.
Hello.
I'm sorry. Yes,
nope,
I'm ready.
No problem.
I'm ready.
Okay,
ready.
I think Brian would know about Benjamin, right?
If I did.
Would you say, Greg? You ready?
Yep.
I apologize to Brian if I muted him. I'm sorry.
Okay, he's all right.
Okay.
He survived. So, yeah. So Brian, you know about Benjamin, or Benjamin, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't read I read a little bit about him and didn't read his essay.
Yeah, you knew that a lot of people quoted him.
Yeah.
So, us McLuhanites are going to find this very interesting, how Benjamin talks.
Interesting. But
yeah. Okay, I think I'll mute you fuckers. You'll probably make noises. So, I want to play this, and I'll mute everybody. Is that okay? Here we go. 1, 2.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts. Before you get stuck into this episode, I want to tell you about some changes we're making to where you can find this podcast. From
Game On, were they impressed by him? Where was he?
He was certainly making them aware of his Paris project, and particularly Adorno, Theodore Adorno, who was mentioned, and his partner, Max Horkheimer, who were at the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt, which was about to move to New York during the war. And he read excerpts of his early sketches to Adorno in the late 20s. He was making his German interlocutors aware of this, but also new connections that he had made in France with some of the intellectuals in Paris, in particular, who were associated with the College of Sociology, people like Georges Bataille, with whom, in fact, he deposited his manuscript when he fled Paris in 1940. So there were also a series of French interlocutors that he engaged with while he was in Paris. And he was quite active in networking with the French intellectuals.
Esther, can we come back to you then? Arguably, Benjamin's most influential work was published in 1935. It's known in English as The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. What was he responding to? What was his main thesis there? It has been tremendously influential. Can you just tell listeners a bit about it?
Yes, this is a tremendously influential piece of work, and it's not really published in 1935. It goes through several versions, and then there's a reduced French version, and it's part of a whole backwards and forwards with Adorno and people at the Institute for Social Research who find elements of it crude, and Gershom Scholem's not a big fan of it. But it has had an immense influence on people wanting to think about how art changes once we are able, first of all, once we're able to reproduce it. So what does it mean that we can hold a postcard of the Mona Lisa or a painting by Monet in our hands? And then beyond that, what does it mean that we can make artworks that are photographs, that we can make artworks that are films that are born reproduced? And of course, those debates extend today when we think about questions around digitality and NFTs, which are so fashionable now. So the core of the essay is trying to work out what happens once you can both reproduce artworks or make artworks which only exist in their reproduced form. And he comes up with a term which he calls aura, which people have debated endlessly. What did he mean by aura? For him, aura is what adheres to an artwork when there is only one of that artwork in one single place, and you in a sense can't approach it because it's authentic, it's original, it's distanced, it's surrounded by a kind of glow of authenticity that, he says, falls away once nobody can say which is the original photograph, or I'm holding this postcard in my hand, that doesn't have aura because I could hold any one of 50 in my hand.
When he says aura, A-U-R-A, when he says aura, he's actually saying, if I'm looking at a reproduction of the Mona Lisa as a postcard, then I am having a diminished experience.
Yes, but you gain as well as lose, in the sense that you can take it into your life, you can take it into your hand, it can become a fulcrum of discussion, whereas were you not able to access it in that way, were you not able to go to the Louvre, then you would have no experience of it. And then it becomes interesting if there is only the reproducible, because there's no original referent that you're missing out on. So in a sense, culture is democratized because everybody has the same access to the film at the cinema. So how does that change the value and the status and the reach of art, and who feels emboldened to speak about it, to get involved in it?
And what does he conclude about that?
Partly he's saying, this is what is happening, let's track it. How does that recompose us? How does that put different demands on the artist? But he writes this very significant epilogue to his Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction essay, whereby he says, who are the experts in using photography and film now? Well, actually, as much as Hollywood is developing, it's also the Nazis. They are able to occupy these forms. And rather than that being a way for the the masses, the many people to sort of participate in representation and self-representation, they become material for the photograph. They're shaped into patterns in the Nazi rallies and so on, and this can then be broadcast back at them to say, look, you are on screen, you are being heard. But he sees it as completely disempowering, and he sees that as an abuse of the technological forms.
Carolyn, can you develop that?
Benjamin says very memorably, the problem in the current age, and of course, again, this is 1935, it's National Socialism, is that politics has become an aesthetic spectacle. So this idea, if we think of the films of Leni Riefenstahl, for instance, of, you know, that the masses becoming an aesthetic spectacle, Hitler being staged and so on. And he says what we have to do in this situation is we need to politicize art. So the Nazis are aestheticizing politics, getting people to just go along with whatever they are trying to do. But we need to politicize art. And what does that mean? And I think here again, aura is quite useful to understand what Benjamin wants to happen. I think it's important to understand that the work of Art Essay isn't just a sort of passive descriptive history of art and technology. It's what Benjamin calls a programmatic statement. It's trying to make an impact. And so Benjamin says the aura and the way we look at, say, the Mona Lisa in the Louvre is part of basically a religious form of relating to art. We stand, we venerate, that the spectator can't really become part of a group of people who can bring about change. So for Benjamin, the alternative is film. Film for Benjamin is a revolutionary medium where the audience is no longer entranced with what's happening on screen, but they are becoming a sort of collective subject who can become aware of itself, become aware of its situation, and perhaps bring about some sort of revolution. And here, by the way, we can very clearly see Brecht's ideas, Brecht's idea of spectatorship, of the epic theatre, where, again, people are not meant to be sort of immersed in what's happening on stage, but they're meant to maintain a critical distance. That's what Benjamin thinks film in particular can achieve. That's what Adorno in particular was very critical of, because Adorno saw film as part of Hollywood, part of this machinery that is just trying to pull the wool over our eyes, stop us from asking questions, just go to the cinema and forget about your troubles. That's what Adorno thought film was like.
Kevin, do you think that what he's describing, the impact of cinema, let's stick with that for the moment, and photography and so on. Do you think that he thought that this was replacing the aura of the unique object, or just something else that turned up and was going on alongside it?
I think he thought that this was replacing the traditional concept of the work of art. And in particular, as I believe Carolyn mentioned earlier, that for Benjamin this was also rooted in a religious tradition of a ritualistic engagement with art that was connected to the concept of the aura. And I would add one further thing here. There's a suggestion in Benjamin's essay on technical reproducibility that there is in fact an auratic quality to the disappearance of the aura, so that the reception of the work of art as it's technically reproduced also involves a kind of repeated experience of this loss of the aura, this disappearance of the aura. So it's not as though this is an event that happens at one point in time or in history at once and for all. This is a sort of long, repetitive process of what he calls the decline of the aura.
I think that's a really important point. And just to add to that, I think there's a real sense of melancholy in Benjamin's argument about the disappearance of the aura. So at some point he talks about the destruction of the aura and how it has to be shattered for a new form of experience to emerge, a modern form of experience which is characterized by shock and alertness. But there is a real sense of melancholy about this process as well. And I think that is very characteristic of Benjamin's work more generally. It's never cut and dried. It's never just in favor of one thing. It is ambivalent about the very thing it also tries to defend.
Benjamin was living and working under threat from the Nazis in Germany. What happened to him when war broke out?
He was in France in 1939, and when war broke out, the French immediately rounded up all German and Austrian citizens living in France who were aged between 18 and 49. Benjamin at the time was 47, so men were rounded up, and women in some cases, rounded up in their thousands, and Benjamin ended up first in the Olympic Stadium in Paris, where he stayed together with all these other people for about 10 days, having to sleep on the ground. There was hardly any roof even. The diet was incredibly poor. And another younger man who was there with Benjamin at the time describes in very moving terms how Benjamin just sat there on a bench, almost not moving for days, and how he very quickly realized that this man would probably not withstand this ordeal. Benjamin was then moved on to an empty chateau, which served as an internment camp. And again, I think there was a real danger to his life at this point. There was a great sense of community. There were a lot of intellectuals and writers, of course, among these exiles in France. So people rallied round. But Benjamin at the time had tachycardia. He had high blood pressure. He had an enlarged heart, and I think he really was in existential danger at this point in his life. He was eventually released, but his health was probably irreparably damaged.
Are Adorno and Brecht trying to help him at this stage?
Yeah, the Institute for Social Research, through Horkheimer, managed to get him some sort of permit to go to the United States, but he's unable to get an exit visa, so he has a partial way out. Brecht is going to leave and go to the US as well. I think it's, you know, there's not much concrete they can do, and he's, you know, leaving Paris was so hard for him. Adorno's wife, Gretel Karplus, who was very close to Benjamin, wrote him lots of letters, you know, spoke about him sort of building a kind of cave for himself out of books and quotations inside the French National Library, and he won't leave it, you know, that he really cannot stomach the idea of going to the US and trying to do what Krakauer and all these other people are doing, trying to find a life there.
Kevin McLaughlin, I know it's a big story, but can you tell the listeners how Walter Benjamin died?
Benjamin had an entry visa for the US, and he also had a transit visa for Spain and Portugal. And this was due to efforts of Horkheimer, mainly in New York at the time. But he did not have an exit visa from France. And so he was in Marseille in the summer of 1940. And finally in September, he set out on foot with two acquaintances who had also been holed up in Marseille, a woman named Henny Gerland and her son Joseph. And they set off on foot for the Spanish border to make an illegal departure from France, because again, he didn't have the exit visa. So when they arrived in the border town of Portbou in Spain, they were told that the Spanish government had just closed the border to illegal refugees from France, and that Benjamin and his party would be returned to the French authorities the next day. And they were put up in a pension in Portbou for the night. At that point, as we've said earlier, Benjamin's health was very poor, and he was barely able to make the walk to Portbou. And so at that point, the hopelessness of the situation, they would have certainly been sent to concentration camps if they had gone back, led Benjamin to kill himself by taking morphine. And he died that night on September 27th, 1940. It was very common for these refugees to carry poison with them. Henny Gerland was actually in the room with Benjamin when he was suffering from what turned out to be a rather protracted death.
I see. Well, thank you for that. Can we look, Esther, at what happened to magnify his influence so much in the years after his death. We've had him in little rooms in Paris, we've had him working away, we've had him getting scarcely any money, but now the Shazam boom, really, isn't it? Can you give us a taste of that?
Very quickly after his death, his friends in New York from the Institute of Social Research start to put together materials, and then Sholem and Adorno come together and decide they want to issue some representative selected writings and also the letters, because Benjamin was such a phenomenal letter writer and so many of his ideas were worked out there. So there's a big editing project, possibly motivated by survivor guilt or just a sense that somehow this man of such extraordinary thought had not really been given his due. He had published books.
So which of his ideas began to circulate and become important and needing to be held in such enormous esteem?
I think it's the 1960s really shoot him up into, begin to, the superstar sort of elevation through his ideas, the work of Art and the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, an essay called The Author as Producer, the much more left-wing works that seem, or obviously left-wing works, which are taken up by the student movement. In Germany, there's a poster of him with a Kalashnikov in one hand and a joint in the other, because he did a lot of drug experimentation, like other intellectuals in the 20s. So he's seen as this figure of absolute liberation, rebellion, and the reinvention of culture. But as it starts to be translated, John Berger alights on the work of Art Essay, and Ways of Seeing is unthinkable without Benjamin's contributions on technological culture. And then from the 80s onwards, the Harvard translation project of Benjamin, increasingly his star rises in the English speaking world, which in some ways it seems to me leads certain directions of research. So it's really, you know, more recently when his radio writings were translated into English, that they were recognized as truly significant, and a new edition of the works was carried out in Germany. Sort of subsequently they were brought together, hadn't been brought together in German really before.
Caroline, is there any way you can encapsulate for listeners to this program what key points he had that struck people in the second half, later 20th century, and still today, so forcefully and had such an impact? What were the, if people had to go away with a few notions, oh, that's what he said that changed, and that's what he said that changed things, what would they say?
So there's a really nice line from the Arcades Project, from this section where he reflects on his method, where he says, "I have nothing to say, only things to show." And that, for me, is one of the most important comments to sum up what Benjamin did, what he wanted to do, what he didn't want to do. Benjamin was not keen on philosophical systems, that kind of generalized, that abstracted, that talked about eternal truths or grand trajectories or teleological developments. Benjamin was an applied thinker. He wanted to really encounter everyday life, everyday objects, material culture. He wasn't really interested in high art so much as people's everyday lives and experience. And I think in that sense, his project is quite similar to that of Sigmund Freud, who also tried to really engage with what it's like to be human. So Benjamin was interested in the body. He was interested, as we've already heard, in fashion, in architecture, in basically what constitutes human life. But he didn't write about them in a grand system or some sort of big overarching philosophical theory. He really shaped his texts to sort of really match the object of his inquiry. And I think that's a very sort of likable trait. I think it means that you can read individual texts by Benjamin, and very beautiful also his essays on literature. He is probably the most influential critic on Franz Kafka. I think his Kafka essay from 1934 is probably still the absolute sort of most beautiful and influential piece written on Kafka, but he really engages with what he writes about close up. And that means that as a reader, you can read these individual texts and they will be self-contained. They will be beautifully phrased. He was a great stylist, but not in a kind of difficult, abstract, kind of pretentious way. But you can then also, the more you read of Benjamin, the more you see certain ideas coming back, you see patterns, but it's not a system. And I think that really sets him apart from what you could call philosophers with a capital P, who I think especially nowadays are quite off-putting to read. I think Benjamin, he's not accessible, but you can engage with him in small texts and then build on that. But every Benjamin text will have something unique and particular about what it has to say about the thing that it's about.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Esther Leslie, Carolyn Duttlinger, and Kevin McLaughlin, and to our studio engineer, Jackie Marjoram. Next week, But Soft, What Light Through Yonder Window Breaks, it's Romeo and Juliet. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Is there anything in the programme that you would like to have said, this is a time to say it, because this could be included in the podcast?
Just to add on to something Carolyn just said, I think one of the interesting things about Benjamin is that his reception is that, as Esther mentioned earlier, certainly the Benjamin explosion happened in the 1960s, and that was the sort of first wave of Benjamin, very much based on Hannah Arendt's edition of Illuminations, a collection of essays that came out in the late 60s. And then there was a second volume that was edited by Peter Demetz in the 1970s called Reflections. And these were the kind of paperbacks that students were carrying around with them in the 1970s. And then we had this massive translation of thousands of pages of Benjamin's work into English, and also the editing of all of his work in German in some, I believe, in 14 volumes in the collected writings. And what's very interesting is that there was both an internal academic reception and a more external popular reception of Benjamin's work. On the university side, I think Benjamin's interest in language and history made him very appealing to things that were happening in the university in the 1980s and 90s in the wake of the structuralism in France, focusing on language, and then sort of turned to history in the 1980s and with the impact of Michel Foucault's work. And I think Benjamin was very well positioned to be taken up from those perspectives, but very hard to assimilate to any of those thinkers exactly. Outside of the university, it's interesting that the fact that he was driven out of the university early in his career meant that he had to write about things that people outside of the university cared about. And so that's what's had his legacy around film, new media in particular. It was very much him trying to bring his philosophical training and thinking to bear on the very practical things that were happening in the culture. And he was forced to do that, as we said earlier, because he had to be a freelance writer.
And maybe just to build on that, I mean, I do think it's really fascinating to look more closely at the journalism, because this is really work that exists in that spot between necessity, constraint, but also freedom and creativity and trying to reach new audiences. So Benjamin was suddenly forced to write for everyday people who would read his stuff in the newspaper, maybe on the commute. So it's a completely different style of writing. I mean, coming back to his Habilitation, which, as Kevin said, was of course rejected with utter incomprehension. And it's a very influential work, but it's so difficult, especially the preface is almost, I mean, it is hardcore philosophy. But then Benjamin just pivots and changes his style. I mean, he's also, of course, a literary writer. We haven't mentioned that. One of his most beautiful books is his memoirs of his Berlin childhood around 1900. He writes riddles. He writes travelogues. So he is just such a versatile writer. And again, that I think ties in with this idea that he's appealing to so many different people and so many different audiences.
I think that's so right, Carolyn, that he's an experimentalist with so many different forms. He's writing short stories. He writes poems and sonnets, but I think, as Kevin mentioned earlier, the radio work is really quite extraordinary. I mean, this has been written mainly for teenagers. Sometimes they're small lectures about something like the Berlin brass factory or toy shops in Berlin or the earthquake in Lisbon from the past and so on. And sometimes, though, he's working with sound. He's working in the genre of the Hörspiel, you know, where you use work that can only really appear on radio, mobilizes all of radio's capacities for sound effects and multiple voices and delay and all those issues. And he's doing that because he is helped by a friend of his who we haven't mentioned, which was Ernst Schoen, who was his childhood friend, who was probably the person he felt sort of closest to all the way through, and kept up a sort of letter exchange with Schoen when Schoen came into exile here. And Schoen was running Frankfurt Radio and saw this as a way to really concretely help his friend who was not going to get an academic job. So he puts him on the radio in a spirit of experimentation, as was happening in Weimar and particularly in Frankfurt Radio at that time.
And I think that's important really also as context for the work of Art Essay, the photography essay. Benjamin didn't just theorize about the new media. He was a practitioner as well in the radio, and he was experimenting. And maybe just another comment on Ernst Schoen. I think it's striking how many different people we've discussed today as being Benjamin's friends, dialogue partners, collaborators. So Benjamin knew a huge range of people, but very, very different people, and in a sense, almost incompatible people. Scholem didn't like Brecht. Adorno didn't like Brecht. So he was sort of in the middle of this incredible force field of different intellectual positions, different ideologies that... So if you look at Benjamin within this landscape, it's almost like he is at the center of all these conflicting strands and movements. And that's what I think makes his life ultimately so iconic for the period, that he lived through this period of two world wars, exile, migration, displacement. And I think it's, I mean, I don't want to stress this too much, but I think Benjamin's life can't really be separated from his work, because the work is absolutely rooted in these often very difficult conditions.
There's actually, if I could just mention it, I often recommend those radio broadcasts to students as a way into Benjamin. And then there's a wonderful moment. I think it's in the radio broadcast on the markets, the old markets of Berlin, in which at one point he slyly says to the audience, perhaps I'll see you in the market, or perhaps you'll see me, but of course you won't recognize me because you don't know what I look like. So the media theorist peeps out of that particular radio broadcast.
Well, thank you all very much.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
Hi, I'm John Ronson, and I want to tell you about a new podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4. It's called Things Fell Apart. If you've ever yelled at someone on social...
Two, three. Everybody's unmuted.
Except for Green Financial. You're not on the air.
Let's see who they are. Who's that? I think he's been here before, he or she, and they did not admit who they were. They recognized the phone number and his address and his birthday. You're not going to say anything, are you, Green? See? See, Greg?
I heard that.
He's a fan of Benjamin. Okay, so what do you think of that, Clinton?
Oh.
Is Clinton there? Yeah, he's there. What do you think of it, Brian?
That's very good. I mean, they're getting to the point about what it was about his life that helped make what he was doing unique, and contributing to his perceptions and his writing style and everything, and how he's addressing people. And,
he was like McLuhan in a way, the McLuhan outside of academia. He was a gadfly, you know, around doing different media whenever he had the opportunity, like McLuhan did.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, doing the different media is one thing, but like, you know, being a guest on a radio show or being a guest on TV or something, but if Benjamin was actually sort of doing some odd jobs in these industries, then that gives you a pretty unique perspective. I mean, you can obviously also talk to people who actually work in them, but it's a pretty unique perspective that comes from doing it yourself.
Yeah, he did do a radio show. They say they're pretty interesting. It sounded like they are geared to young people, but I don't know if they all were.
Mm-hmm.
So,
are those available?
Yeah, go ahead.
The radio shows?
Maybe in some kind of archive somewhere, yeah.
Those would be fun to listen to.
Yeah, great. Did you see what I sent you yesterday, the animation?
Yeah, I did. But I couldn't get to it somehow. I mean, I clicked on it, but it didn't seem to go anywhere.
Yeah, you'd have to write their names out and find out where they are. It was an interesting inventory I just stumbled on Twitter, and it's really all these intellectuals talking about animation and books and stuff. And anime, so I thought you might be interested. So
I did go to it, but I'll try a little harder next, again, see if I can get to the meat of it.
Right. So what's interesting about his essay, are you there yet, Clinton?
Yes, I was up in the kitchen, but I was listening the whole time. Thank you. That was a very informative little piece, yes.
Yeah, so in his essay in 435 on the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, he is trying to relate the new media experience to concepts and Marx. And McLuhan said that Marxism is a genre of literature. All the Western intellectuals after World War II who are in sociology and political science and that, they write, you know, books and that on Marx, that the citizens of the East have no access to. We don't even know it, don't know anything about it. So you have this Gutenberg after image done by the Marxists. So this guy is worrying about Gutenberg arts like Mona Lisa and what happens to that precious experience where you look at a painting by yourself. So there's the individualism of Gutenberg arts. And then now they're in this mass thing. And he's, if that's his first essay, he's worried about the effect on the experience of Gutenberg art. But at the same time, he says, there's something new here. It's very democratic. Everybody can have an art experience. But it gets rid of the aura. So it's like McLuhan said about Barth. Barth related his media studies to the concepts of the day. And McLuhan says, I don't relate to the concepts. I don't bring in what I'm talking about and relate it to different systems of thought or philosophy or aesthetics and that. And I would say that McLuhan's less conceptual approach allowed him to understand the services and disservices and the ambivalence and contradictions of the new media experience, new electric media, more than anybody else. And this is an example because people read Benjamin and they can't understand him because he's trying to relate it to concepts because he's philosophically Gutenberg trained. So So he can't drop it. And, but it appeals to the thinkers of the, baby boomers and older who, like philosophy. They prefer Benjamin over McLuhan because they want to relate it to the book world. So that was the, first thing that they talked about. You know, they said he was interested in daily objects, the objects of everybody's life. So there's the they don't get the electronic post-object world that McLuhan talks about. Baudrillard probably does later, but I think it's really interesting. I mean, I've met Esther. I stayed at their home twice in 2008 and 2011. And we didn't get a chance to talk. I knew what she'd written and her opinion, but I wanted to bring in McLuhan. And I don't know if she ever listened to me and Ben, her husband, what we did. But if we get much dialogue out of this, I'll send it to her. So, what is it? Ejectamenta verbally, what you think of this, Clinton or Brian. Mm-hmm. What you pick up.
The biographical details were helpful. Then again, it's also, again, we didn't get too much of what Benjamin was about in his writings, although it's clear that his life and his work were interrelated heavily.
Yeah, well, the women, that Carolyn, I think she pointed out that there were contradictions. Nobody knew. He didn't have opinion. He said, there's some new democratic effects of this film, but the Nazis are using it for the turning politics into a spectacle. So they were saying that Erdogan or Benjamin and his gang at the Frankfurt School, he wanted to politicize art. But what they miss is that radio and movies and TV are the art environment, are the art. They want to take, I don't know, write, get Brecht in his theater and whatever other arts, Gutenberg arts they're involved in, music, composition, Stravinsky, whatever. They want to politicize that, the old Gutenberg arts. They don't get the radical statement that by McLuhan that we have evolved a million years once we have radio. And nobody's going to take that seriously, but we now know what that means. It's actually more accurate. Look at what happens to society with the digital media. So I think he's, for me, Benjamin is really useful to point out his contradictions and why he stuck there. And then you can understand McLuhan better when you see that McLuhan doesn't get into the area, what would it be, complicated thinking about just what's in front of us. What is radio doing? What is film doing?
Mm-hmm.
They don't, McLuhan, he doesn't worry about what happens to the aura of Gutenberg art. He just says, it's gone. And now the new media become art in phases. Movies become art, then TV becomes art, then computers become art. And, you know, he's using art very differently than the Gutenberg people. And, of course, the Gutenberg people didn't even know McLuhan was an art theorist.
They right.
Read enough to get that.
Yeah.
McLuhan's entire sidestepping of concepts just for giving people proportionate perceptions of whatever he happens to be perceiving at the moment is it's disorienting to people who would prefer a model within which their perceptions to fit, right? But
their conceptions, their ideas.
Yes, yes.
Their loyalty to the Marxist revolution or whatever they think they're doing to knock off capitalism. So, you know, Greg, again, Greg knows nothing about this guy, but it is what happened to your Trotskyists, Greg. All these people that you found objectionable at CKLN had gone to university and read this stuff. And that's what they were all confused about. They didn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah, because there's a big divide between people who haven't gone to university and those that have. Because just because you've gone to university, of course, doesn't mean to say that you're learning and the other people aren't.
Right.
Or that you're experiencing and the other people aren't experiencing. Or coming to ideas or sorting things out.
Yeah, it
because
makes sense.
When you go to university, when you go to university, you often have other people sorting things out for you.
Yeah.
And then you're sort of kind of motivated to, in a lot of respects, to go along with what they're saying because it will benefit you in some way.
Yeah, these intellectuals that you ran up against at CKLN, they felt superior to the masses, so they had no qualms about manipulating CKLN and using it for NDP purposes or political purposes, right? Their cynicism is what used to piss you off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it came from them reading these kind of things.
And their lack of general principles and things like that.
Well, they could rationalize it by saying, well, we're in a new environment. Things are different. We got to do revolution differently.
Well, there's a lot of ends justify the means going on. I mean, everybody's guilty of that to a certain extent, but... they do it a lot.
You found it puzzling. You'd think they were very ridiculous when you go to their meetings or whenever you encountered them. And so I'm showing you where their ridiculousness came from.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that he was crossing into all these media, film and radio, using sound effects, sounds like, right? This German guy that he was involved with, they were doing funny things with sound.
Yeah.
Experimenting.
So he was actually, becoming acceptable. He would have been, if he'd survived the war, he probably would have become a big phenomenon. Not just from his books, but his radio work or theater. Well, what was interesting is that the other big intellectual who was a big influence in the late 60s, Adorno, he disagreed with Benjamin on what the meaning of film was. He just said, this is just mass brainwashing. You know, he had another weak view of media. He couldn't see the 50 kinds of snow that, Inuit or Eskimo can see, right? They just said, this is just people who can't think, can't write, can't read.
Uh-huh.
He was too blanket Gutenbergian. Whereas Benjamin was trying to understand the present more, what was going on.
Right.
I mean,
and it also teaches you to, carry around some poison with you, just in case.
Say that again? I missed that.
This radio program that you played for us, I think it gives us the idea to carry some poison around just in case.
Right. Yeah, you mean you may get captured.
Yeah, you might be in a situation that you can't get out of, and then maybe you're not feeling all that well, have some health problems. You think, oh, what the hell? Let's just go. And people will be talking to me. If the world survives, people will be talking about me on the BBC in 50 years or 60 years or 70 years.
You know, I think they talk about that
first
poison thing, Greg, in the first part, the first 20 minutes that I didn't include. I think that's what Benjamin may have carried stuff around.
Well, it seems like he did.
Poison on him.
Well, what it also taught me is I better start writing some stuff. I mean, before you go and get the poison, start writing. Start making more radio. I mean, here are some radio shows. I mean, I did a little bit of experimentation on this radio show, very, very minor, just a few moments ago. But, maybe do some more of it so that, but got to do some writing. Then get the poison.
Yeah, you mean you would do writing? How would that help you?
Oh, because it would make you more iconic. Because then people would be saying, hey, he wrote this thing Greg Duffel wrote this thing, and well, nobody understood it.
Yeah, but, you should become a journalist, Greg.
Yeah,
for Now magazine. Material.
And then write some incomprehensible material, then yeah. Write some stuff like for kids, you know, and you just specifically written for kids. People are going.
Well, guess what? We have someone who already does that. Brian. Brian writes incomprehensible stuff. Let's hear about your how'd that work out, Brian?
He's got to write, but from this radio show. It's important that you write incomprehensible stuff. And write some stuff that's accessible to various age groups.
Yeah.
To create the confusion. Yes. Because if you just write the incomprehensible stuff, then people go, well, all he wrote was inconsequential, ridiculous stuff that nobody could understand. But if you start doing some other stuff in other media that is accessible and that people understand, then they'll go, maybe there's something in that incomprehensible stuff.
So you're saying you need to write more comprehensible stuff.
Yeah, I have to do a bit of both. Then go get the poison.
Yeah. Well, Brian, he infiltrated Queen Street West, and he got in a band. He went to the street. Right, Brian?
Yep.
With his
trying to build the normal audience there, the more accessible, kind of become known to people for doing something more accessible than whatever bizarre, cryptic, convoluted ravings I've become known for in New York.
Yeah, you're well known in all Slack for incomprehensibility.
Yeah, there might be a point buried in there, but I buried it under some layers of overthinking.
I don't think Clinton, they don't know what you wrote 10, 15 years ago. He used to write very convoluted, like psychological statements about what he was writing about. As he was writing, he would be talking about the response, and then he'd I'm looking at you, you're looking at me, and I'm looking back, and you're looking back at me. That kind of stuff. You know what I mean, Brian? How you would write
there
that.
There was some of that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I'm trying to include everyone's objections in what I'm writing or something, but not in a clear way.
Yeah. Now, is that because you were stoned? Would that be a stone condition?
Yeah, that would have something to do with it. But I was also just sort of, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. I was not very laid back about my living. Yes.
You were conceptual psychological.
Yes.
Like you're in a room talking to somebody and watching their responses to your complexity and anticipating how they were thinking about what you were saying to them.
Yep. And just because it's a, I don't know, it's a complex thing.
Now, you've been blurry. Is he blurry for you, Clinton?
It is a complex subject, you know?
Yeah.
Coming through?
Yeah, but you're weak.
Yeah, I'm a stronger kid.
Where are you? You're too weak.
I'm in the kitchen.
Okay.
Well, get out of the kitchen. Get back where you can be heard.
Stop being such a woman and get out of the kitchen.
Yeah. Stop trying to survive.
If you can't stand the heat on this show, get out of the kitchen.
Well, I was hoping for more discussion of this. So do something. Make up some more shit about this, what you heard.
Well, I mean, the thing about the aura of the work of art, I think, was picked up and run with by Derrida, right? I mean, this whole idea of the presence and the idea that you're in the presence of the work of art that the artist was also in the presence of, his presence, or his or her, whatever.
He talked a lot about absence. It was very complex.
Right, yeah, I mean, he was doing the turning it on its head, like that, and tracing out the consequences, the unnoticed consequences of our privileging of presence, and the idea that our sort of automatic scorning of, like, well, a mechanical reproduction is simply not as good because it doesn't have that presence. But then that also speaks to this sort of elitist idea of not everyone is able to access the presence of the original painting, but the mechanical reproduction allows it to reach the masses, as it were, without needing to funnel them through that elite space of standing right in front of the painting.
Yeah, I liked Esther's point about what the postcard did. People are saying, wow, I can look at this picture of my own home. I don't have to go to the Louvre. That's quite a change.
Kiss my aura, Dora.
Yeah, kiss my aura, Dora, said Frank. Esther has written on Frank. She knows that quote. But the it's interesting that he was noticing this and other people weren't noticing it or something. Donno said, this is not important, the fact everybody can look at the painting now. So there was a lot of confusion. It's, Joyce out-confused them with Finnegan's Wake, and then McLuhan was able to figure out how to, you know, get past the book. He knew the book had done it, either through Ulysses as the last novel, and then the Wake as the last book itself, the book experience. That'll, because he looked at those things, and many people didn't, many professors weren't aware of those works in their respective fields, he broke through. As he said, they broke into that silent sea. When you read McLuhan now, he's so simple.
I think that was Carpenter's phrase. Not so silent sea.
That's right, yeah, Carpenter, they both used it. McLuhan uses it. You'll see it in Pro and Con, that collection of essays.
I do know it's a famous line from Coleridge Taylor's Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, right? We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea, right? But
McLuhan used it in that Pro and Con book in 68, and then Carpenter makes an essay using it in the early 90s for Robert Fulford. Right? So we know, and then Don Thiel reprints it. So we know that phrase from Carpenter later, but McLuhan used it. If you have Pro and Con, you can look it up.
Oh, okay.
In the introductory essay, I think.
You know, it's something.
Raymond Rosenthal.
I've got a coffee book table here by Camille Paglia called Glittering Images, and she does art analysis and all these paintings and works of art and whatnot.
Yeah.
And, it's full color reproductions. And it sort of has me thinking about how Through the Vanishing Point or Mechanical Bride would be different if they were in color, or if they were in glossy pages, right? Well, like if they were reproduced, if you were to make a new edition of Through the Vanishing Point with color glossy reproductions, how would that change the experience of the book? Right? I think it would matter a great deal.
Did you say would matter?
It would matter. It would matter a great deal.
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
Become coffee table books.
Yeah,
it'd
be great.
Christmas present.
Imagine 12-inch by 16-inch Through the Vanishing Point with big glossy pages. That'd be awesome.
And then nice different fonts for the poetry.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The poetry part.
Just this idea about the reproductions of art that has got me thinking along those lines now. Yeah.
So. But if you ever go back and read Understanding Media, it's so ridiculously simple. Like, he just keeps repeating about visual space versus acoustic space or tactile space. They're saying that Benjamin was very innovative stylistically. I think he wrote some novels, wrote essays. He was a beautiful writer. McLuhan was not a beautiful writer. What he was pointing out was beautiful, but it was just clunky, the way he wrote, what he stuck to, right? Because he didn't want to get into concepts.
Yep. Yeah, he was often
just a single sentence idea kind of a man than the
writer. Yeah, aphoristic.
It's pretty punchy sometimes that way.
I find McLuhan's writing beautiful. I find it immaculate, but I suppose it's not.
Well, you're reading the earlier stuff. I'm talking about Understanding Media and War and Peace. With the collages, they're prettier books. But look at Cliched Archetype. It's just all about what are cliches and what are archetypes all the way through the book. He'd take a dialectic and impose it on all kinds of object themes. Like he would quote concepts but make them subject to the conditioning of either visual space or tactile space. So everything got reduced to the spaces. Hey? Are you there?
Yes, reduced to the spaces. I agree. I mean, that's literally, like, spatial conception is everything. Your percepts occur within a spatial environment. Some aspect. That's everything.
Like, I know people, because they repeated this basic reduction to sensory spaces, you know, from 68 on, people who liked aesthetic writing, they liked writerly writing, they found McLuhan boring. They didn't get what he was saying, but this guy's just saying those same stupid words all the time. You know, acoustic space, tactile space, for the next 10 years. And they got turned off. They wouldn't read McLuhan. I remember Ben Watson, he discovered in our doing this stuff on the radio in 2008, came across McLuhan writing in the 40s, you know, making fun of New Yorker magazine. You know that famous, the New York Wits or something, that article where it's a tremendous article where he criticizes the style of New Yorker thinking. They're a bunch of dilettantes.
Oh, is it? Yeah, the Winchell bit, the gossip page, where with the.
No, just the different humorist, the kind of humor in the New Yorker. So Ben said, "Wow, this stuff is great." Ben was very impressed with that little taste he got of the early McLuhan, but that's because it was writerly and it was dealing with cultural objects that Ben probably thought was snobbish or something. They weren't populist enough. And Ben advocated just getting out there and just taking. He says, "Why don't the workers just go out on the street and take over the factories? There's more of them than managers." So he always was loyal to the strike, that idea. Even though he was learned in high culture, wrote about Finney's Wake and all these things. His education at Cambridge, he applied that to the Zappa book, and the Zappa fans, the average post-literate Zappa fan, couldn't stand Ben's book. They didn't understand what he was talking about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and, you know, so Ben will be brought in to speak on the BBC, like for the Zappa thing that's coming up this weekend, because he's illiterate and learned enough. He's learned enough to give that literate hangover BBC effect.
Oh, he gives some respectability to a conversation about Frank Zappa, I suppose.
Yeah, about a pornographer. And remember, McLuhan said, "Why the CBC must be dull." Wrote that in the 50s. Because it was the dominant content, the dominant radio and TV experience, it couldn't lord it over people. So it put on this patina of the people's medium. But they were very snobbish about it, like the host of the show that we just heard. You know, they have this English accent. And McLuhan used to say that, you know, the North American can't take the European accents because it's a tribal mask. People go out to be social, not alone. In Europe, they go to be social, and they put on this corporate accent, whereas North Americans have a very private face and a private tone. They don't know how to put on a corporate image because they're so individualized by the Gutenberg and kinetic environment of industry.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You remember reading that part of McClellan?
Yeah. The contrast between Europe and America is always prominent there. Wow, neat. So that's a good find, Bob. This little show, and then they're doing Zappa this weekend, you said?
Yes, the BBC is doing an all-day thing. They're playing Stravinsky, all his heroes, and him, and talking about it. I'll post one of the pages on it.